Welcome to this week's edition of Dugout Dish Podcast. I'm Andy Kirikides, joined by my wonderful co-host who's repping Brockport Lacrosse today, Keith Glasser. How are we doing?
Great. How are you?
Good. We got another guest on this week. We got the assistant coach and recruiting coordinator from Franklin Marshall College, Matt Ribisell on. Matt, thanks for joining us, man.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. Really excited for it.
We do this at the top of every interview, but take a couple minutes and kind of give the listeners your background and how you've gotten to where you are today at Franklin Marshall.
Definitely. Yeah. So originally from Bergen County, New Jersey, went to Paramus Public High School. Kind of struggled in the recruiting process just because I was never really connected with that, big of a travel organization. Our town was competitive enough during the summers where a lot of families didn't seek that kind of outside help. But through some channels, eventually ended up going to Muhlenberg College, also in the Centennial Conference. Played for Coach Gross there for 4 years as a catcher. Just had an unbelievable experience. Met my now wife there, which was awesome. And then I kind of got a unique path into coaching. We had a coach there my freshman and sophomore year. His name's Dave Anderson. He was a pitching coach who I actually stayed with on my overnight visit. And he had moved on. He was at Emory at the time and was coaching in the Coastal Plains League and essentially had a super low paying assistant role and said, "Hey, I think you can do this. Would you want to use it as like an internship?" So it was hard to, pass on what I'd been going to school for, which was media and communications, but decided to go into it, give it a try. My first experience was coaching kids my age in the Coastal Plains League and had an unbelievable time. From there, my girlfriend at the time, like now wife, was going to med school in Erie, figured it would be a cool way to kind of be able to get a job out there. First coaching job at the college level was at Allegheny College for Brandon Crum. Unbelievable experience, gave me a ton of autonomy to, work with catchers, work with hitters, and really find how I could coach at this level, do a little bit of recruiting too. From there, COVID hit. We played a 5-game season. COVID hit and was actually able to come back home for a little bit. Coached for the fall at Fairleigh Dickinson Teaneck under Coach Datoma. Again, throughout my whole path, I've been super fortunate to work under unbelievable head coaches and work alongside some really great assistants as well. Never got to coach a game at the Division I level, but again, kind of being like an intern for the fall in that program was great to see what athletes are like at the Division I level. From there, moved on to Roanoke College, 2 seasons there, was able to lead the offense for the first time in my life and recruit on a pretty national scale up and down the East Coast. Had another short stint back under Coach Roman at FDU Teaneck, and then this will be my 3rd season now at FDU. Where again, as the recruiting coordinator, like you said, and hitting coach, catching coach as well.
Yeah, you dropped a couple familiar names there. Coach Gross, guy that we've rubbed elbow with plenty over the years, going back to when he was at Davidson, actually.
Yeah.
And then Coach Datoma is a good friend of both of ours. We've had him on the podcast. He's doing some good things out in San Francisco. I know they're chomping at the bit to get that first game going in a couple weeks here. So no, great for that info. I mean, I think one of the common threads that a lot of guys have talked about when they come on here, and Keith will attest to this too, is that you're oftentimes a product of the people that you get a chance to learn from, and having some really good mentors and people that kind of can lay the groundwork and help you figure out who you are as a coach and learn from them. It's a huge piece of the puzzle, and having some of those guys to lean on for you, I'm sure, is helpful.
Yeah. Unbelievable recruiters, teachers of the game, even like some of the behind the scenes stuff like fundraising. I've been able to learn some really great people, and even those who I never really got to coach a game with, just like seeing how they run a program, how the other assistants interact with the players. I've been super fortunate to work with and alongside those who I have.
Yeah, you got a good one now too with Coach Horning. So,
oh yeah,
you're in good hands with Ryan. So first question we open up with, because it's unique to every different place, and obviously you guys are kind of a high end academic school. But talk to us a little bit about how you guys go about identifying guys in the recruiting process, and then maybe talk a little bit about the timelines at which you guys operate under, and maybe we can use the 2026 class as an example of when you start to identify guys, bringing guys on campus, all the way down to the point where they ultimately decide that F&M is going to be their home.
Definitely. Well, it's obviously super complex, and I know that what we do isn't necessarily what everybody does, but definitely some commonalities among schools, especially at our level of academics. You know, we're number 31 in the country for liberal arts colleges in the U.S. News and World Report, right in between, I think, Bucknell and Lafayette, just to give a comparison. So the first step when it's on, you know, we always want to make a baseball identification first, and what we're specifically looking for. We really try to have a well-rounded roster. Like, as the hitting coach, my goal is to present a lineup that gives an opposing pitcher like 9 different problems to try and solve. We don't necessarily recruit the same type of offensive player to go through the lineup 1 through 9. Just like on the mound, we've got very different styles of pitchers. Some hard throwing bigger guys. We had an all-conference pitcher last year who was a smaller lefty that was not throwing with a ton of velo, but just threw you know, a ton of off-speed pitches and was really effective. So from a metric standpoint, there's no one thing that we look at and say, if it's this exit velo, we're interested, or if it's this arm velo, we're interested. We're more so trying to recruit to what our roster needs. From an offensive perspective, though, I really try to look for, how can a hitter get themselves to second base? Are they really high on base, and then can move themselves with a stolen base, or, you know, causing chaos on the bases? Are they a slug type of hitter? We had a lot of that in this past graduating class, and I kind of anticipate we'll move towards a more athletic lineup this year. But I've, across the board, at every level, at every program that I've worked at, the really good hitters can get themselves into scoring position by themselves. From a pitching standpoint, as a younger coach, I was definitely, especially not on the pitching side, I was more of go get high velo and make it the pitching coach's problem, which I know is totally unfair. But now we've seen how that's played out, and we're really looking for guys who might not be the hardest throwers, but can command a couple of pitches in the zone, throw from a funky arm angle, just give the hitter something that they're not used to. So I would say on each side of the ball, those are two things. On a timeline perspective, we are a little bit earlier than most Division IIIs. We recruit really based off of our own early decision deadline. And for us, that's November 15th. Trying to make sure that we're not procrastinating, we typically end up recruiting kids between June and the middle of October. Obviously, you know, there's some circumstances outside of that where we'll get a kid a little early or a little late, but most of our recruits are committing within that time frame.
In terms of identification, what are some of the mechanisms that you guys use in order to do that? I know there's a lot of different avenues to do this, whether it's showcases or on-campus camps, or you're going to driving up to Diamond Nation for a day. I know a lot of people rely on kind of some close personal contacts. How does that look for you guys, and where do you try to find your guys, or what's been the most fruitful for you?
Yeah, all of the above. I can definitely touch on how we use or attend each of those. Ultimately, I think the biggest thing, when a kid sends us an email with their summer schedule, we want to see some type of high academic event, right? We're not going to events that maybe just appeal to the masses. If we're going to spend some of our limited recruiting budget or resources on going to something, we want to make sure that the players that are there are likely to have interest. Maybe, you know, not likely to all want to go to F&M, but at least be in that high academic realm, you know, to make sure that we're on the right track. And like I said, using those resources appropriately. So our own camps are huge for us. They've kind of blown up over the last couple of years, but over half of our recruiting class in each of my seasons has been from our own camp. I think we do some things differently in terms of how our own players interact with the prospects and, you know, including things like a campus tour and stuff like that, that give families the idea of what F&M is. But we also go to showcases like Head First, Play to Win. Richmond runs really great camps down there that we can kind of expand our geographic footprint with. You know, like you mentioned, Diamond Nation, I only live about 45 minutes from there. So it's really easy for me to get out there and see like Super 17 and stuff like that. And then, you know, going to other schools, colleges, universities, camps that are similar to us. So we go to a lot of the Ivy League's prospects camps as like a guest coach. And like I said, Richmond and some others that we definitely circle on our calendar and say, okay, every year we're going to make sure we hit these.
Yeah, we used to always get up at the Columbia camp. We used to always have some Franklin and Marshall representation up there. So,
yeah.
You kind of got an additional role. I want to give you a second to talk about this and hoping you can kind of tie it back to how you guys can use this as something from a recruiting perspective. But I know you're going to add up kind of an academic focused team for Elite Baseball out of PA with a couple good friends of ours, specifically Jonathan Grasse. Talk to me a little bit about that and how that is another way for you guys to identify players.
Yeah. So being with a Division III program, we have a little bit more access to what we can do with club teams. So Ryan Horning, the head coach at F&M, and myself had worked with Elite National when they've put together some academic events in the past. And the feedback was like, how can we provide the best experience for families that know right off the bat, we want a high academic school. We don't want to sacrifice academics for trying to play college baseball. And what we did was just put together an entire schedule based around going to high academic events, going to Ivy League, Patriot League, Centennial schools, getting on campuses, really primarily in the Northeast, since there's such a high concentration of high academic schools in that area, but making sure that we're not going to some of the bigger, more national events and saying, hey, come see us play. We're basically saying we're bringing the high academic kids to these events that we know high academic schools will be at. So we're really excited for that. Through Elite's previous high academic events, we've definitely brought kids into our own program. So, you know, it's been a really good way for us to see players that probably have an interest in F&M in a more concentrated space.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. I know there's some other coaches who do some similar stuff up in the Northeast region where they have the ability to be tied to a travel organization, and kind of organically you get to see a decent collection of kids because you're at some of these tournaments. And I think it's something interesting that you guys do. And I think it's something interesting that Jonathan does, and something that, you know, benefits. It's kind of a symbiotic relationship there. You know, the kids get an experience having a chance to play with a college coach. But you guys also get the advantage of, to your point, being at a location where, you know, the academic kids are going to be there, because that's essentially what it's designed for.
Right. And, you know, there's obviously some really great companies and organizations that run that type of system and structure from a showcase standpoint. But we're really happy to kind of bring the game side to that and participate in these team camps and tournaments while keeping that academic focus. I think that'll be valuable for the families.
So you touched on, and you're not the first person to say this in the academic world, but I want you to maybe walk me through the process of, once you identify a kid, kind of what are some of the next steps that you take being a high academic school? Because every Ivy League coach that we've talked to, me and Keith were in the academic space for a long time, there's a common misconception that we're looking for grades, that you're looking for a student who wants to play baseball. But the reality is you need a baseball player who's a really good student, and you hit at the top that it all starts with talent. So maybe talk about why that's important, right? But two, once you identify that kid, what are some of the steps that you take, and what does that process look like for a recruit? that you guys are actively having some interest in?
Definitely. So there's really two ways that, you know, we'll start interacting with a kid. The first is through them reaching out. And I think it goes unspoken. Like, we do end up committing kids and going through a full recruiting process with players who do reach out to us first. And we might not have known about if they didn't take that first step. Usually it's a little bit easier because one, they're already showing interest. And two, they typically will attach their academic achievements and transcripts and stuff, you know, in that initial reach out. But, you know, the more regular way for us to get a kid on the radar and then complete that process, we'll start with us, you know, identifying them at some type of event. And then from there, you know, Ryan and I kind of go back and forth. And what we've found, you know, he's found this more than I have, but typically kids know whether or not they want to go to F&M pretty quickly on. So I'll try and get them on the phone. Then the next step is bringing them to campus. And again, we try to make that on-campus experience as resourceful for the families and as informational as possible. We want to put all the chips out on the table. And, you know, from there, like I said, that when we hear back, it's usually pretty quickly after the visit, try and, you know, get them in touch with maybe others who have played for the program or other travel coaches who have sent players to us, you know, just try and get them in touch with people who know a lot about the program and can share their experiences as well, because neither Ryan or I went to F&M, but especially Ryan, you know, he's been there for so long that he can really point guys in the right direction to make sure that they know what they're getting themselves into. And ultimately, whether when we offer a guy, we want to make sure that that's the case. Like when they get to campus after a semester or after a full year, they don't come into the office during their exit meeting and go, that was not at all what you described it to be. So it's an extremely transparent process. You know, we do keep a smaller roster, so we are not as quick to just pull the trigger on kids after seeing them maybe one time, or especially like if we haven't seen them live. So that's really, really important to us. But yeah, you know, that's typically how a process will go.
At what point in that process are you guys looking to check that academic box, and how does that look like for you guys?
I would say we identify a kid by seeing him live. That first phone call or that first email that I send letting them know that we're interested, we would like to see that academic info. And there are a lot of times where we get that back and that's where the process ends. I would say that that's like probably 80%, honestly, of players that we really like. And just with the admissions process that we have, we are able to support players who we are offering a roster spot to. But again, we can't just do that across the board, even if our roster was bigger than where it is right now, around that 36 number. So typically, you know, we'll bring in around 4 pitchers a year and fill the positions as we need them. But yeah, that's, you know, typically we want that academic information right away.
Yeah, I can attest to that. Having been at Vassar, and I know Keith can speak to that at RPI, that obviously you need talent first and foremost. But once you identify that talent, you don't want to drag it on with anybody that doesn't have a chance of getting in. And I know that everybody's admissions departments work a little bit different in terms of what that communication looks like, but being able to get a quick turnaround, and sometimes even just from basic experience, you can look at a kid's transcript and be like, man, this isn't going to fly, or hey, this is what a kid who gets in here looks like. But that's I think it's important for listeners to understand, whether it's high academic Division I, where the transcript and the scores legitimately do matter, or whether it's high academic Division III, first and foremost, you need to be good enough to play in that program. And I think oftentimes it gets flipped on its head, where people think, well, I'm a really good student, so I should be able to play at F&M. Not really knowing, one, the level of play that's required, but also having a little bit of a misunderstanding of what that process actually looks like and how coaches are actually going through it.
Yeah, certainly. I always really value when a kid can come and watch us play during the spring. Now, it's obviously really difficult with them being in their high school seasons too, but we try if we can to have that happen throughout the process too, because you're certainly right. You know, there are certainly high school coaches and certain travel coaches who will say, I've got a guy that's super high academic. He'll get in on his own. And that's great. But if we can't verify the baseball piece, we've got talented players. So does every team in our conference, whether they're at the top or the bottom. And, you know, just like in the Liberty League, NESCAC, conferences that are known for their high academics, the kids who aren't necessarily getting a lot of playing time doesn't mean they're not good players. That there's talent on these rosters because coaches are going after good baseball players who are also really great students.
Yeah, I know it was one of my pet peeves, and Keith, you might be able to speak to this as well, but having people reach out and just not really understanding the level of play or thinking that just because they have grades, it's going to move the needle. And I think the reality of it is that, yeah, it makes it easier if a kid's a great student, but he also needs to be a really good player, or at least be a player that you think is going to improve your roster in some way, shape, or form, whether it's a fit positionally or they have the prerequisite talent that's required to be able to contribute in your program. Like, nobody's looking for guys that are just there. You always want to think that a guy has a chance to actually do something and, you know, be a contributor in some way, shape, or form at some point during their career.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's like anything else in college baseball. There's a lot of misunderstanding of the levels of play within all divisions. You know, there's really good Division Ones, there's really good Division Threes, there's really bad Division Ones and Threes, and really good Twos and bad Twos. You know, but I think that there's, for the most part, I think it comes from a good place when people do it, because they legitimately think that the kid has a shot, but they just don't have a reference as to what it is. And, you know, I had this quite a bit when I was coaching, but I was 2021, I think. We had a kid that, you know, he got in school on his own. He tried out, right? And couldn't tell you who he was. He was an infielder. Ran like a 7.6. Punched out 9 times in the inner squad. And I got an email after I cut him that people from his area would not want to come to RPI because he was a really good player. And, you know, being young and a head coach, and I responded and I was like, well, clearly you've seen my team play and you know that he's better than everyone there. Like, all of my catchers and half of my pitchers run a faster 60 than him. Like, he punched out 9 times against college arms. Like, I don't know what to tell you, man. Like, he's just not good, and that's okay. Like, I think the thing that people forget in this business and in this game is that, you know, if you're going to go play in college, and, you know, essentially what, you know, what we're all saying here is that you have, you know, what is it, 7%, 8%, we'll round it up to play Division I, II, or III baseball. Like, that's 92% of people that aren't going to play college baseball. Like, we can flip it on its head all you want. Like, but just because you're good, you know, or where you come from doesn't mean that you have the right to go play college baseball. And, you know, it's the Liberty League is stacked with guys. The NESCAC is stacked with guys. The Centennial Conference is stacked with guys. Like, there's dudes all over college baseball at all of the levels. And you know, I say this, you know, it sounds like I'm being, you know, hyperbolic, but I'm not. Like, it's 92% of people aren't going to do it. And that's just a reality. Like, you have to be really good at playing this game, and you have to be able to stand out amongst the outliers. And that's where, you know, I think, again, back to the original point, like, I don't think it comes from a place of, you know, they really like the kid and the kid was really good for him and he's a great kid. And, you know, by and large, we've all come across that, right? Like, he's okay. Great kid. Like, yeah, great kids don't, you know, just because he's a great kid doesn't mean it doesn't translate to wins all the time. You know, might be a great clubhouse guy, but if I have 35 great clubhouse guys, like, I might not be throwing out wins on the old overall record there. And at the end of the day, like, that's what this is about, getting wins and losses and being able to compete and make runs into the playoffs and, you know, be able to compete nationally. And I think that that's something that people kind of lose sight of, especially at the Division II and Division III level, when it comes to, you know, kind of the recruitment and things like that, is that you can legitimately compete at a national level at the Division II and Division III world, because it is set up regionally, and you can be a team from New York and go to the World Series and win it, like Cortland has done, and, you know, Ithaca has done, and you know, a couple other schools. But, like, you know, you can be from a non-traditional baseball powerhouse school and compete nationally at those levels. And, you know, to wrap your mind around that, like, you have to be really good in order to do it at those types of schools and in those arenas. And, you know, it's, I think people kind of don't understand that part of it, which is why we do this podcast, to talk about the recruiting end of things and the realities of college baseball. But, you know, again, I don't think that it's, I don't ever think that it comes from a place of malice, if you will. It's just more of a lack of understanding. I'll get off my soapbox.
No, but it's something that we have to talk about frequently with families. And, you know, we do in-person seminars and talk about the recruiting process. And I feel like frequently we have to debunk this idea that Division III baseball is an extension of high school, when I don't think it could be farther from the truth. And you guys have great examples of that in your program, not only this year, but in recent years, of guys, because of COVID years, moving on from Franklin and Marshall and going being major contributors at legitimate Division I programs. And I think that in an odd way, COVID has highlighted how good Division III baseball is, because you're seeing guys from FNM, you're seeing guys from University of Rochester and Amherst, and there's a whole slew of schools where guys are moving on to Division I programs and being legitimate contributors. I mean, there's College World Series teams at the Division I level. I mean, the starting second baseman for North Carolina this year was a Division III guy. The batting champion in the ACC for Virginia Tech, center fielder, was a Division III guy. And I think it's shined a little bit of a light on, there's a lot of really talented players, in that you need to be a really good high school player first, but that still doesn't put you in a position where you're necessarily good enough to play in certain programs. And I think that kind of ties back to exactly what you're talking about. Like, you guys, despite being as academic as you are, it's always going to start with, is that kid good enough to play baseball here? And then we need to put the rest of the puzzle together after that.
Yeah, no. And what's been really cool is that obviously during COVID, it's given something, or given guys something to work for. Being a school that doesn't have graduate degrees, we couldn't just kind of hoard guys and say, okay, I know this is year five or six, but you're going to stay here and help us try to win a conference championship. It was cool to see some of those players go on and have incredible careers, not just make a team, but, like you said, you know, be main contributors on really good rosters. You know, Kyle Roche most recently at Richmond, throwing, I think, over 70 innings and breaking a record for how few walks he had, 3 walks over 70 plus innings. JJ Freeman's another one at the University of Delaware, who was the starting shortstop and an all conference player by the time he graduated from with his master's, and others too, who have, you know, played at some other really great programs. And even now, you know, we were talking before going live about a player that we have who unfortunately got hurt last year, but has that ability to help Richmond out next year on the mound. And you're right, the talent is there. And it's different at the high academic level or sphere in terms of the transfer portal, because a lot of times, like, these schools are really, really sought after and people don't want to leave, even if they're not 100% satisfied with the situation that they're in because of the degree that they're earning. And it's, oh, you know, it's really difficult to transfer in to a school like FNM. You know, FNM wants you to graduate having taken FNM classes, not necessarily at your local community college or even some other really good colleges or universities, the value is in the degree that you're getting there. So they want you to have those classes under your belt. So it definitely plays a role into the entire recruiting landscape. And it does make it difficult on high schoolers. And you're right, you know, there's a lot of people who want to play college baseball, but unfortunately might not be able to.
I think you bring up two interesting points that people don't necessarily think of in the high academic world and probably specifically Division III. One, like not all colleges like you guys like don't have grad school. And that is something that was, you know, has been prevalent with the COVID years and it could be moving forward with guys who might want to, you know, try to transfer out and things like that. You know, where I was at RPI, we had, you know, we did have grad school and we also had a 5-year master's program that a lot of guys were into. So, you know, I benefited from the fact that a lot of the guys got into that program and, you know, they weren't necessarily trying to leave. Because I mean, shoot, if you can get your master's and your bachelor's in 5 years, like why not do it? You know, but I think the other thing and the more prevalent one in the world that we currently live in is that transferring into higher academic schools is tougher to do than most people think that it might be. And, you know, I think it might become a little bit more prevalent at some schools, but, you know, like the mid-year transfer is not really a thing at most Division III high academic schools. And even the other one, like when I was at RPI, it was a hard deadline, like April 1 maybe for the fall transfer. Like half those kids don't even know that they're leaving their school until the end of May. And then they call and they're like, hey, can I apply to transfer for the fall? And it's like, hey, can I get this kid in? They're like, yeah, no, we're like 2.5-3 months past the deadline. And, you know, like it's a little bit more difficult at the Division III level to kind of get that transfer in, you know, in the higher end academic world, right? Like, you know, if we're talking the SUNY system and my wife coaches in it, like, you know, it's a little bit different than it is than, you know, trying to go to FNM or RPI where like, hey, no, like these are hard deadlines. Like we don't have room or whatever it might be. So, you know, I think it's an interesting point and it's going to be case to case and school to school on what they can and can't do. But, you know, the kind of the idea of thinking that like, hey, I'm just going to jump in the transfer portal and transfer to a Division III school, a high academic world. Like it's not as cut and dry as it might be if you're trying to go to a Marist or a Siena where I played and coached. So, you know, it's a little bit of a different animal there than it is, you know, at different worlds. So, you know, just I thought that was interesting. I wanted to pull that thread a little bit.
The other thing that's interesting about kind of the COVID years, and I think that you have the roster cuts, which is a slightly different change at the Division I level. But I think both of those things, I think what it's done is it's raised the floor of college baseball. I think it's harder to play college baseball now than it's ever been because a couple things. One, I think kids have access to way more development tools. There's a lot more kids specializing in just baseball, but I think the competition level is higher. And I'd be curious to get your thoughts on this. I think you've been in it long enough where are you guys recruiting a slightly better player than you did 4 or 5 years ago at Roanoke? Do you think that that's impacted how you guys structure your roster in terms of timing? You know, I've talked to a couple different guys that, you know, they have access to what they think are better players because there's less spots for these kids to go now at the Division I level. You know, there's going to be 1,800 less Division I spots coming up. Do you think that's going to benefit Division III baseball? Do you think it changes anything that you guys do from a recruiting perspective?
Definitely. I think there's going to be some sort of trickle down now. I don't necessarily think that kids who, you know, are looking at Notre Dame and Stanford are all of a sudden going to be interested in a plethora of Division IIIs. But I think that sooner rather than later, you know, the quality will, I mean, it already has, but it will continue to just improve across the board. Yeah, and like the facilities that guys have access to, the remote training options that guys have access to, you know, you don't necessarily need to just have a really great facility within an hour of you that you have, and you know, the kids in the Midwest or across the country don't. But overall, yeah, I see what's out there, and there's 100% a higher tick and velo, kids who can hit home runs during batting practice, at least like on command essentially. And I don't remember that thinking just a few years back. And again, does that always translate to game? No, but I just using that like 4 or 5 year sample size, the triple digit exit velos, the metrics that we see at the end of a scout day or showcase or camp, they're definitely more like grown men metrics rather than, you know, what I've been used to seeing in the past. Metrics that I would almost expect out of a second or third year college player rather than a junior or even a sophomore in high school.
Yeah, it's been pretty eye-opening to me being out on the road, you know, the last 3 or 4 years and kind of seeing the impact of it. You know, you get into August and I'm seeing a ton of like 85 to 88 mile an hour righties who 8 years ago, 5 years ago, like those guys are probably Division I scholarship guys or at least in the conversation for a roster spot. And that seems to be what a lot of Division III schools are sorting through at this point. I think it's really good for the game. I think it's a testament to the game continuing to grow. I think college baseball has become just immensely more popular due to all the access that people have to games, being ESPN Plus. But I think the training, and then I also think that there's just less spots for kids. So you get more kids in that range that seem to be accessible to Division III schools, where I know, you know, when I was at Vassar a while back, that wasn't the case. You know, you were hoping a kid was going to get to campus and be 85, 87. You know, you're projecting out that kid who's 83, 84, you know, all right, well, he gets a little bit stronger. Like he's going to be 85, 87 when he gets here in his freshman year. And now you're seeing those kids, they're already there before they even get to campus. I think that's cool. I think it's something that is going to really raise the floor. And I think it gives programs like yourself, like I think that high competitive Division III program, I think they're just going to continue to get better and better.
Yeah, 100% agree.
So we've talked a lot about kind of the talent piece, right? And obviously that's a huge portion of, but there's another massive portion of this recruiting process, which is trying to identify the right kid, right? Not just the talented baseball player, but finding a kid who's going to be a fit for FNM. What are some of the things that you look for, and how do you try to evaluate the character side and kind of the personality fit for FNM?
Yeah, I think that the two main ways that we attack that process are during the visit, and then if we're fortunate enough for that family to be at our camp. At our camp, the prospects are spending a lot of time with our current players. Our current players work our camps. Our current players run Q&A sessions. And we do collect that feedback from them and say, you know, who seemed engaged, and not necessarily taking the players that play the best and then go, did this kid act the right way? Or, you know, it's really just trying to ask the broad questions and see who showed interest, who was super engaging, who could you see yourself being friends with down the road. It's a small snapshot, but it's kind of the best we can do, especially for those families who are from farther away. And then on the visit, you know, every recruit that comes into the office, we tell them, like, we're a coaching staff that likes to have a lot of communication with our players. We've got guys coming in the office all the time, and it's not always to talk about baseball. Sometimes those conversations about what's going on off the field can put a mind at ease, or just, you know, let a player know that we're in their corner, we have their back, and that can go a long way to kind of unlocking what they can do on the field. But at the end of the day, I think Ryan and I are both in the game for the relationships that we can build. So we want to make sure that we're bringing kids to campus who are going to, you know, mesh well with what we have going from a team culture standpoint. But also, you know, bring a good personality to the team. One that is going to buy into like team concepts and one that can communicate for themselves. At a school like FNM, the student who maybe sits in the back of the classroom and is a wizard on the computer or the calculator isn't necessarily the best fit for that small classroom style that we have, for that small team atmosphere that we have. Those who can communicate, those who don't need parents to answer questions for them, those who can kind of talk about their experiences in their current high school program, current club program. Those are the ones that I've learned definitely get the most out of their experience at a place like FNM.
Yeah, those interactions are so important. And I think that every coach that we've had on, and me and Keith talk about this a lot, is how you interact with other people is going to clue coaches in to quite a bit about you, right? And you mentioned one thing that we try to try to make sure we highlight for families is the parents who are at the forefront of a visit. And you don't really hear that much from a kid. As a coach, you're looking for a confident kid. You're not looking for a cocky kid necessarily, but like you're looking for a kid who has enough confidence to be able to look you in the face, give you a good answer that comes prepared with some questions. And a lot of times that can really move the needle one way or the other, because at the end of the day, you're evaluating a slew of kids. Even when you get down to, like you said, all right, we bring in four pitchers a year. Well, you're not just recruiting four guys. So somehow, some way, you need to get down to the four guys that you really like. And I know on my end, and I'm assuming it's probably very similar for you guys, when you get down to decision-making time, feeling really good about the human being you're getting is a big piece of the puzzle in terms of when you actually make that offer. Because to your point, you want them to mesh. You want them to get to FNM and you want them to excel. And I think that it doesn't get talked enough about broadly. Like we're on Twitter, it's all about metrics and it's all about the video, which is great. But if you really want to separate yourself in the recruiting process outside of the talent, you need to develop some of those soft skills and be able to communicate with a coach. How do you interact with, you know, your teammates? How do you interact with your coaches? And I think it's something that is really important. And I got to imagine it's a differentiator for you guys.
Yeah. I mean, I think the best way to put it is we talked about before how the talent level at all levels is rising. You're right. We are recruiting a larger number than four pitchers if we're bringing four in a year. There's a lot of kids who are low 80s, mid 80s. Yeah, sure. Some of the differentiators on the field, this kid cuts the ball. This kid has a lot of arm side run. This kid has a great secondary pitch. But oftentimes we're kind of bucketing those players and saying, long term, this is the max potential, or this is where we see this group of pitchers going. How do we decide on that one? Well, if you stand out on your visit because you talk about how you're self-motivated, especially at the Division III level, we're not able to have as much coaches interaction with our players, especially during the fall, during the off season. But that doesn't mean that our guys aren't working hard, whether it's captain's practices, saying self-motivated in the weight room, going to hit or throw, like being on an actual plan. We need to find the guys that can do that, because it's really easy when you have a parent or a coach at home saying, hey, you need to come in. Like you signed up for a 20 lesson package. Like you're going to do that because you've spent the money. But we need to try and find the guys who don't need us to say, hey, you have to be at this lift. You have to be doing these things. They are self-motivated to go do that. Like I said, they can communicate with their coaching staff. They can communicate with professors. And you're right. They take the lead and can talk about themselves. And that's hard. Like you said, social media creates a culture of self-promotion, which can be detrimental to some, but it, you know, when a guy can talk about themselves in a very frank, like clear way, that can go a long way in saying, I think that kid is going to be a really good fit in this program.
Yeah, it's an important piece of the puzzle for sure. You mentioned that, you know, you don't always get a chance to be hands-on with a kid all year round, right? It's a little bit of a different setup than Division I and Division II. It's not optional if you want to be good, right? And I think that that's something that needs to be said. Like guys who are at the Division III level, the ones who excel, they don't do the bare minimum. But can you expand a little bit about how the fall works at the Division III level? And then I think it's also important to touch on how you guys integrate the strength program into what you do to help guys get prepared for the spring.
Yeah. So our fall season, we're allowed to go 24 days and we will use all of those dates. Luckily for us, we're in a situation where in the past at the Division III level is pretty regimented on like how many times you had to go a week, how long it can be from start to finish. Now it's just 24 days. So, you know, we know of some programs that go 2 days a week for a lot of weeks. And we know like us, we go 3 to 5 days a week, depending on weather, depending on other things we have going on around campus, you know, to make sure that we're making the most out of those 24 days. Aside from that, though, the guys are participating in a lot of optional type of workouts, optional type of captain's practices. And I can say genuinely that our senior leaders year in and year out do an unbelievable job of instilling this culture that, yeah, just because we have these rules at this level doesn't mean that we're not going to put in the extra work. And the guys do an unbelievable job of making sure that they know that it's really outside of the 24 days during the off season that you can make those gains that will really show player to player, program to program. So we're fortunate to be in that type of atmosphere. I also think when those systems are in place, it's a lot easier for guys to buy into what they're doing. You know, there's a lot of their own thoughts, their own, like what they want to do in that planning, which is great. And that does trickle into the weight room where we do have a strength and conditioning coach for the school. He works with we have a lifting committee that work hand in hand to put together our workouts for the year. Our guys are lifting 12 months a year. They are lifting in season, but out of season, our upperclassmen do an unbelievable job of, you know, setting the standard that the weight room is really important. And I think over the past few years, at least from when I've joined the program, while other programs, or, you know, it's really what we hear from other coaching staffs that we're close with, when they are starting to break down towards the end of the year, our guys are pretty similar across the board in where they're at in terms of velocity on the mound or, you know, maintaining hard hit balls. And I think a lot of that is because of the work that they're putting in the weight room, which is important during the season. But like you mentioned, to kind of touch on the fall, like that's where a lot of those cultures and processes are formed and constructed.
I mean, that ties right back into getting the right people, right? Because it's not all quote unquote mandatory. And if you have, like you said, with your seniors, guys who are going to kind of hold the line and hold everybody to a high expectation, you get way more out of that. And, you know, you talk about the in-season lifting, and we've had some guys on recently specifically to talk about the strength and conditioning portion of it. And it's such a huge piece of it for college players. And we try to get across to the high school players that, you know, if you want to be a college player, you got to start doing stuff that college guys do, and being able to get in the weight room during the spring. But it's a huge piece of the puzzle, and it doesn't change from level to level. It's just the rules are slightly different. And I think that's important for people to understand that the guys at F&M are putting in just as much time as just about anybody else. They just might have to do it outside of their regulated time with you guys. But if you have good if you have good people and you have a culture in your program, none of that ever becomes an issue because they know that's what they need to do to begin the spring.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. We've been super fortunate to have some great leaders in the program that, again, like, I consider myself lucky that when I get in the car to leave the office during this time of the year, because, you know, we're not allowed to start until February 1st and even earlier in the fall, I don't think, wow, I hope that they're doing what they need to be off the field. I'm like, oh, I know that they're doing what they need to, whether it's a throwing program, they're lifting, they're hitting, like they have the facilities that our school has, which is incredible. But they find a way to get their work in, even if the weight room's closed for the day, or, you know, they can't use the batting cages. They do a great job with that.
I think it's one of the harder things at the Division III level. Getting kids and your team culture to do the things that is necessary because you don't have as much time with them as other levels of college baseball do. Excuse me, everybody.
Yeah, and I sorry to cut you off, but that's part of the recruiting process too. Like, there are families that think, okay, we want to choose Division III because there's more of that work-life balance, just to use kind of a general term. We do want recruits to know, if you come to this school, if you play for this program, you've got to put in the time. Otherwise, other guys are working hard and they will overtake you, and other programs are working hard and we will not win. So we need guys who, you know that coming in, and don't come to us at the end of the first year and go, I can't believe that I wasn't naturally progressing like everybody else when I didn't do the lifting, or I didn't do some of the extra things that have just kind of become regular for our guys keeping themselves in shape and developing.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the harder things, I think, at the Division III level. I think that it's one of the, I've gotten on the soapbox before, and the NCAA doesn't listen to this podcast, but there's no reason for Division III to be handicapped from a coaching standpoint in the way that it is. Like, I coached at one of the toughest schools in the country, and I know that my guys had an hour a day to do some individual stuff to be able to continue to get better. And ultimately, like, you know, yeah, you're right that people think that it's a work-life balance playing Division III, but, like, you know, as a coach, it gives you the kids are there to play baseball too. Like, they want to get better. And is it better for them to do it with a coach or just on their own all the time? Like, yes, there is absolutely time, and it doesn't matter where you are, where you're going to have to go do things on your own in order to get better. But you can, I would make the argument that you could find more success and lead to better culture, better teams, better competition in being able to coach your kids a little bit more from an individual standpoint. You know, the other is it gives you the pulse on your team. Like, it lets you check in, you know, multiple times a week of like, hey, how's everything going? How's class going? What's going on with school? Because it's the same thing that you do in the spring to make sure that guys are, you know, getting what it is that they need to get done. The fall, you know, under the old rules especially, was like, all right, here's 16 days and see you when I see you. And, you know, and then you get to the end of the semester, it's like, why does Johnny have a 1-9? Like, I don't know. I haven't seen him in 3 months because I can't. Like, what do you want me to do here? You know, and I just think that it would create a better overall student athlete experience, since that's the trigger word or phrase that we like to use nowadays, that, like, it would create a better overall experience for student athletes to be able to have that type of access to their coaches and things of that nature. But I think the right step was going to 19 weeks and allowing you to use them how they want. But I do still think that you should be able to have, you know, a little bit of individual type stuff in there. Like, schools are tough.
When you guys put that petition together, I'll make sure I sign it.
Yeah, I'll get out there and pick it. NCAA, Keith Glasser, former baseball coach, listen to my ideas.
One day the pod will have that much reach. We're getting there slowly but surely. Now, the culture's huge, and it doesn't matter what level it is. And I think it is, to Keith, your point, at the Division III level, like if you want to move the needle year round, you got to have guys that are going to bring the other guys along with them, right? Because you do have to count on them to do stuff when you can't be there with them. And it's huge to get the right type of kid, and not just that fits the school, but the kid that's going to fit your program and be able to assimilate and kind of continue to evolve the culture and raise the standard within. So.
Well, you do, and it makes some of those conversations at the Division III level a little bit more difficult, because it's like, you know, why am I not developing? Like, I'm not getting to the point where I need to be. Like, well, what else are you doing? Like, if you're only going to work when we have practice, it's not enough. And it holds true in the recruiting process. It holds true when you get to school. It holds true at every single level. Like, you're competing against your teammates, and you need to be able to do more and get more things in. And, you know, you can certainly go hit on your own all the time and take video and send it to your coach and be like, yo, what do you think? I would argue that there are very few coaches in the country that wouldn't actually really like that. Like, oh, you're texting me video of your swing? Ugh, I don't want to look at this. Like, spare me. If you actually want to do this job, there's a, like, that fires you up. Like, all right, my guys are hitting at 10 o'clock at night in the cage and I'm getting videos. Like, yeah, man. Okay. We're going to be good this year, I think, you know, and I just, you know, it's a lot more, there's a lot more self-motivation. And I think that it leads eventually to some self-assessment that we all look for as coaches, that, you know, there needs to be a little bit of self-assessment and self-awareness of where you're at. And, you know, it can't just be doing the absolute bare minimum and thinking that you're going to be penciled into the lineup in the four hole and, you know, having a ton of success. Generally speaking, the guys that, you know, really work at it are usually the ones that find themselves in the lineup and find a little bit more success than the guys who just do the bare minimum. Now, are there guys out there? Yeah, there's guys out there that can do the bare minimum and be good, but those are outliers. And we don't, like, we do that stupid thing in this world where, or in this sport, where we take outliers and make them the rule. And that's not generally the case.
Well said. Well, Matt, the last question we ask everybody is for you to give some advice to college or to high school families, high school players who are either in the recruiting process or have aspirations to play college baseball. Any advice that you have for the listeners with regards to the recruiting process as a whole and that whole college selection?
Yeah, I think there are two big pieces that I try to, you know, when either I'm working with the club program AP or, you know, just at an event where I'm talking about these types of topics. The first is the recruiting process really needs to be a proactive one. Again, you know, even some of the schools that are the richest and have the biggest endowments in the world, that doesn't mean that that money is going into the baseball recruiting budget. If there's a school that you're really, really interested in, you need to put resources into getting in front of them, whether that's going to their camp or even just making sure that you're keeping the coaches up to date on what you're doing, a summer ball schedule, for us academics, obviously, and, you know, video every now and then. But again, if you're just kind of expecting the schools that you like to come and see you just because, it's going to be a really tough process. And you're probably not going to get, you know, the best fruits for your labor. Also on the flip side of that, non-responses or no's are valuable information. We get them as coaches. Families should be prepared. And just because you get a no doesn't mean you're not good or not good to play for that program. Sometimes it's just a matter of numbers. Like, if you're a great catcher, I might think you're a great catcher, but we already have a catcher in your class and we're not looking to bring in two. You know, that doesn't mean that, again, that doesn't mean that you stink. But it's better to explore your options to find the right home than just trying to keep bark up the same tree when a coach doesn't have that wiggle room to play with. So that's kind of on a recruiting side. As a development piece of information, I think right now, because of some of the things we talked about, the access to information, you know, everybody's got their own pitching and hitting coaches, even like strength and conditioning coaches. We're seeing what a lot of people would deem like really great mechanics. Guys are good movers, but at the end of the day, they're not strong enough to have an impact on the field. The mechanics, the motion on the mound, the swing can be as pretty as possible. But at the end of the day, if he can't hit the ball over an outfielder or through a gap, it's going to be really hard to hit at the college level. And although velocity isn't everything, if you cannot be competitive at a certain velocity, depending on what level you're looking at, it's going to be really difficult to play college baseball. So making sure that as a high school, honestly, that's one piece that I wish I could go back and tell myself as a high schooler, putting an emphasis on being strong, on being fast, on being mobile, that can go a long way. I think a lot of times a coach is more willing to bring in an athlete who is strong, but might not move the best, as opposed to a kid who everybody goes, oh, that swing is beautiful, but you know, their max potential is singles over the middle infielders.
No, I like that. I like that a lot, because the strength piece, the game has gotten so physical. It's gotten so physical, and it's why we brought a couple guys who are at the top of their field onto the podcast to speak about that specifically, is that you can acquire skill. Like the skill acquisition is, I don't want to say it's easy, but it's a lot easier to get reps on the tee, in the batting cage, with your infield coach. And it's also generally a more comfortable environment for a lot of young kids. But the weight room is what I think moves the needle for 99% of the high school population. There's just not a lot of guys who run around college baseball weighing 150 pounds. And if they do, there's something, once again, to what Keith is saying, that they're outliers. Like the 150 pound guy who can hit the ball 380 feet is an outlier. That is not a normal dude. He's doing something physically that most people just don't have. Yeah, everybody's weighing 175, 180, 185, 200 pounds. And that's up and down college baseball. It's not just at the Division I level, but everybody's more physical. And if you want to keep up with the Joneses per se and get yourself in the mix as a player, as a recruit, probably the best thing you can do is make sure you're hammering the weight room as frequently as you possibly can and stay healthy. And I think most kids, their swings will get better. Their mechanics will get better just because they're able to get into positions that they weren't previously able to, because they're physically more capable of doing it.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you can swing the bat fast and under control, you know, you have the strength to move quickly without being unbalanced, either at the plate or, you know, if, as long as you can move your arm fast and create a lot of force without putting your arm at compromised positions, you can be really good even if the mechanics aren't perfect. So that's always something like that will stand out to myself, and I'm sure a lot of other coaches too, is that physicality.
No, I think that's great advice, and I'm glad we were able to end it on that, because the proactive piece is huge. We say frequently that if coach doesn't know where you are, it's really hard for them to see you. And a lot of that has to do with doing the outreach. It's tedious sometimes, but you know, coaches do pay attention to it. And that strength component is massive for young kids who are going through this. So great advice for everybody listening. Well, Matt, glad we had you, man. Really appreciate you taking some time out. I know you guys are getting started later this week. Obviously, best of luck to you and you guys go short as the Dips.
Yeah, Go Dips. Go Dips. That's actually our like athletic website, Go Dips. But yeah, I appreciate it. This was awesome. Recruiting is one of my favorite parts about the college game. So I'm always happy to discuss that with families and answer questions, and you know, just try to give people as much information as possible, because it can be a really confusing process for people. So what you guys do, shedding light on a lot of those topics, is super helpful to families out there.
That's why we do it, man. But once again, thanks for coming on. you know, tell Ryan we said hello. Good luck getting prepped up for the season. I know you guys are opening up in Mary Wash, so we'll be Dip fans for that weekend.
Thanks. Thank you.
All right. Thanks again, Matt. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Tune in next week for another episode. That's all. Thanks, everybody. Thank you for listening this week. If you're watching on YouTube, go ahead and hit that subscribe button and smash that like button for us. Check us out on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, as well as Spotify. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at EMD Baseball. If you want to find out what me and Keith do to help families and players navigate the recruiting process, go ahead and check us out on emdbaseball.com. Take a few minutes to check out our new online academy. I promise you'll get some good information out of that. Thanks again for listening. Check in with you next week.